that I process information by writing. This might be something that I'm studying, where writing and rewriting it helps me cement the concepts in my mind. Or, and this was what was most startling for me to learn, was that I process my feelings and my thoughts much better when I take the time to write about them. I have never taken up that daily practice of journaling very effectively, but I do journal when needed. And those text messages and emails to friends, those also serve as a form of journaling that helps me articulate the things that are already happening in my brain. Then when I was in my 40s, and I was faced with what was to me at the time a catastrophic personal event that just sent me absolutely flailing into a therapist's office, I also learned that writing about what had happened or was happening to me also began to serve as a way to help me rethink my experiences. My therapist, having homed in on my writing identity, assigned me one writing assignment after another and another, and challenged me to tell my story in a different way, the story that I told myself. In doing so, it helped me grow my self-esteem and put a major depressive episode in check. It's with this background and experience that I chose to work with the sermon Telling Stories by Reverend Rod Richards of the Unitarian Universalists of San Luis Obispo. I may be a writer, but I'm not a minister, and I haven't been to seminary, so I'm not as adept at pulling on the threads of lessons that make them meaningful for a broad range of people. So today I'll be sharing parts of Reverend Richards' sermon alongside my own experiences in a way that I hope helps bring his sermon to life for you. So since I won't be providing his sermon in its entirety, and because some of the lessons of how he shared his sermon include the impact of storytelling in social and racial justice issues, I would encourage you to read it in its entirety. I'll provide a link to it in the next newsletter, and I'm happy to email it to anybody that's here today. Just let me know. Reverend Richards writes about loving to read. So while he enjoyed academic books and other nonfiction, he loves to read stories. This resonates for me and is particularly in my mind attached to that incident that sent me running to the therapist. In short, the situation was this: the end of a 5-year relationship that, as I learned at the very end, was to a pathological liar. The unraveling of what that meant was earth-shattering, both to who I was as a person, to what I had been living for half a decade, and worst of all, to what it said about me as a mom, which was my highest priority. For years before this moment, perhaps even 2 decades by then, I had leaned towards reading a variety of nonfiction, self-help, political, biographies, religion, science, and more, but the various forms of self-help books were taking up most of the space on my shelves. Now, looking back, that was a symptom of how I felt about myself for a long time, that I was some form of broken or not good enough, or perhaps I was an adult that never really learned how to adult. I was convinced answers were in those self-help books, and anytime that I did visit a therapist, I would gobble up any recommended reading, thinking that was the right thing to do and the right homework for my money. So in the weeks and the months that I was spending trying to hold it together after this relationship debacle, one of my coworkers approached me one day with a suggestion that changed my reading direction for the better. It was a particularly bad day for me. I'm sure you could absolutely see the pain and confusion that was on my face, and my eyes were puffy from having cried all the way in on the drive. This coworker wasn't a particularly emotive person. In fact, she was pretty prickly most of the time, and she didn't know the details of what I was going through. So for her to approach me with this conversation was odd, to say the least. So she had my attention when, out of the blue, she said, "I'm gonna give you some unsolicited advice." "Okay," I said. I wasn't sure at all what was coming next. And she said, "The thing I found to get me through really hard stuff is to read a lot." Sure, I said, I love to read. I'm reading this book my therapist gave me, and she interrupted me. She said, no, not that. I mean books, stories. Read about people, read fiction. Okay, I hesitated. The suggestion was even more odd coming from her because she was an historian. I had never pictured her reading a single work of fiction, actually. So, like what? I asked, looking for a book title or something. Anything, she said, read fiction, read about others. Okay, I will. I said, not as sure at all that I would, and really walking away wondering what that was all about. So, I didn't think too much about it, but as a few more weeks went by, I got really weary of the therapy books. It was exhausting, all of this thinking and introspection and working on myself. I remembered my colleague's advice and decided to take a break from it to read fiction. And that began what I still think of as the rest of my reading life. I rediscovered my love of fiction and the way that as a child, I would just rip through one book after another after another. And I started to enjoy reading for the pleasure of reading and not because it was teaching me something. I found it relaxing and restful to really what was a tormented brain at the time. And it filled this void that a toxic relationship had been consuming for years. Renewed in my love of reading, I set a goal for reading for the year and I blew it away in 6 months. I learned for the first time ever in my 40s, that I loved reading historical fiction. And historical fiction that at the end of the book outlined the facts where the author filled in blanks or took larger liberties was really amazing to me. I could totally enjoy these tales and learn something cool in the process. Even if the fiction was only lightly based in history, I loved to read about how human beings time and time again survived. How even when half of the world was wiped out in plague or countries were decimated in war, people went on. They continued to hold hope, to have children, to build and rebuild. It made me feel like my problems were manageable, and to be completely honest, at a bit times trifling. Reverend Richards talks about this effect in his sermon. He says, so both nonfiction and fiction hold stories. It's just that the stories in nonfiction are true, and the stories in fiction are non-true, right? And he says, not so fast. First of all, we would have to agree on what true means before we ask that question. And he continues to write, I remember being in a writer's group way back when the piece that was up for discussion this particular evening was a short story I had written. One of the first questions was, did this really happen? How much of this is true? And before I could answer, my friend sitting next to me, a writer with a newly published novel, grabbed a hold of my arm. Actually, as I recall, sort of threw his arm in front of me as if we were coming to an abrupt stop in an automobile. And he was my parent protecting me from smashing into the dashboard. And he said, don't answer that. It's completely irrelevant. The story is either true or it's not. It doesn't matter if it happened. So Reverend Richard says, repeats, it's either true or not. It doesn't matter if it happened. And he says, stories, art, poetry, music, the free reign of the creative imagination can provide truths in a unique, engaging way. Though the details of what happened in the piece may be made up, the underlying awareness may point to something irrefutably real. In that sense, fiction, understood as fiction, can be true. And nonfiction, yes, can be a lie, even when it apparently tells what happened. Reverend Richard says that understanding these aspects of the stories we tell, the stories we live out, and the stories we live in, it's always been important, but it feels particularly relevant to this place and time. This place and time abuzz with accusations of fake news and conspiracy theories and alternative facts and revisionist history. This place and time when truth has become a matter of stubbornly arrogant determination rather than humble exploration. This place and time when fiction cannot even keep up with the fabrications that pass for reality and nonfiction strains even the most fearless imaginations. And he says, It's important for us, we Unitarian Universalists, to be clear on this, because we are explicitly the people of many paths to truth, of direct experience of that transcending mystery and wonder of the inherent worth and dignity of every person, and making space for the stories we each carry. It could be said that we have contributed, unintentionally, but sometimes carelessly, it could be said that we have contributed to a post-truth world. But are we not actually telling people that truth is whatever you decide to believe? Are we? Sorry, he said, but we are not actually telling people that the truth is whatever you decide to believe, are we? That any story, every story is true. So, back to my life and my visits to the therapist. She had this tactic to challenge me that I still refer to in my head as the or game. It was her way of forcing me to rewrite the stories in my head, the beliefs that were truly crippling to me in those days, causing intense anxiety and depression. So here's an example of how those conversations would go. I would say, I just don't understand how someone would just disappear, how they could do that to me and my child. I mean, he lied about so much. He must not have actually loved me. And my therapist would say, or, dot, dot, dot. And I would just stare at her like a deer in the headlights, knowing in my soul that this person had not loved me. Or, she would repeat, waiting. And finally, I'd muster an or to the best of my ability. Or he enjoys manipulating people. Or, she would say. So with my last answer, having reached into the depths of my mind and scraped the back corners of my existence for words, I was really struggling to find an answer. Or he doesn't know any better, I would say, throwing up my hands in exasperation. Or, so now I'm getting angry. What does she want? I'm out of ideas here. Yet she waited. Sometimes I'd get visibly mad and I'd tell her, she'd just have to tell me the answer because I really didn't know. And she'd laugh and say, there isn't an answer, keep going. So one side of my brain would ponder, why am I paying this woman an exorbitant amount of money to torture me like this? And the other side would keep probing for answers. Or he has problems and loved me, but he doesn't love himself. She might smile, nod, and then infuriatingly say, or? So around that point, I would start to realize maybe the or was about me. Gross, I'd think. And then I'd come up with something like, or I need to love myself enough to be careful with those I accept love from. And then I'd give her my credit card and leave. So how many of my statements were true in the or game? All of them. But the first and the last statements tell two very different stories on their own. Reverend Richards talks about this as well. He says, I just think about the stories I tell myself about myself, my life. It's good to know that I'm not locked into a single story or a single interpretation of a story, that any single story can open up into a new perspective. But there's also a danger in believing every story I may create. For example, let's say, going back a few years, that I haven't finished my homework. Now, I can tell a story of a very irresponsible person with a questionable character who didn't finish his homework because, well, that's just what he would do, or in this case, not do. Or I can tell a story of a person who chose to not finish his homework, in this case, because another worthy activity called out for his time. Or I can tell the story of a person who gave in to laziness, was irresponsible for not finishing his homework, and has learned from this mistake. Any of these stories bear some connection with what happened, though they are wildly varied in perspective and interpretation and would carry markedly different ramifications in my own understanding of myself. But if I instead tell the story of a bad dog who ate my homework, the homework that I never finished, then I have left the realm of many paths to truth or many interpretations of reality, and entered the realm of lying. The fiction that I have introduced is not acknowledged as fiction, and it's not meant to illustrate a deeper truth, but it rather intended to cover up the clearly evident truth. So, back in my therapist's office, I wrote and rewrote the stories of my life in a series of exercises that I continue to use as a coping skill today. So in my head, was that a terrible date? And this is back then. I've been married for a while now. Was that a terrible date I went on, or a great evening out as a single mom where I ate yummy food and met a new person, learning yet more about what I liked and disliked in my company? Was that a project at work that didn't go at all the way I expected it to go, a failure because it missed the goals? Or was it an incredible learning experience where I flexed some skills, built some new ones, and developed great ideas for a different way to implement the plan next time? Both, and in fact, many more things can be true at once. I can see the truth of the bad date. While appreciating the opportunity to dress nice and be in public, flexing my dating muscles where I learned to say no thanks to a second date, something that hadn't actually been in my wheelhouse before. I can stop beating myself up for a work plan that went sideways while acknowledging there were hard lessons learned and small successes too. My therapist eventually assigned me a writing assignment to write a vision for myself. This was a difficult exercise. She flatly rejected my first draft, something that hasn't happened to me since ninth grade English teacher nearly bullied me out of not picking up a pen again. Fortunately, my 10th grade journalism teacher reversed that. But anyways, the mean therapist said, nope, I'm not good enough, try again. So I went back to the drawing board. On draft two, she said, okay, I need you to be more clear on who you are. Not what you want, who you are. I want to be able to see this person you are and want to be. So I thought I had done that, but she said, no. Ask a friend how they see you and get back to me. So I was annoyed, not used to having to do multiple drafts, and I decided I was going to show her. I asked about 10 of my friends, my ex-husband, my child, a handful of colleagues, and a few people I hadn't spoken to in years. What do you like about me? How do you see me as a person? What do you see for me? So this was 2014, and I'm going to read just a little piece of this vision statement for you. Keep in mind that when I wrote this, I didn't believe any of it, at least not on drafts one and two. By drafts four or five, I was kind of starting to get the picture, but it took a few more years of living it and a lot of editing to get my story right. And so I wrote, I'm a good, strong person. I am a great mother who gives her daughter everything she needs, and it's evident in the young woman she is becoming, how smart, strong, capable, and emotionally sound she is. I have tremendous inner strength. I can seek validation from friends when needed, but I usually draw on my inner reserves, which are vast. I know I am smart, capable, funny, talented, beautiful, and desirable. I am worthy of great love. I have tremendous love from family and friends. So this vision of who I am included paragraphs about, I was surprised to read, about how I worked to build an incredible UU church community. How I gardened, traveled, spent quality time with my friends, financially helped my parents, and had a peaceful, enjoyable life where I felt I had a positive impact on those I loved. None of those things were true that year, or at least I didn't feel like they were true. Not any of them. This was a forward-thinking statement and a vision board that was in written form. In 2014, my life felt like a complete failure. I felt unlovable, unable to sustain a romantic relationship, and worse, just so much worse, I was bankrupt. My home was in foreclosure. We were teetering on homelessness, and I was terrified about what would happen next in my life. I felt like I had failed my daughter, failed my parents, failed at work, and generally wasted my life at that point. Reading over this statement this past week, I can now say that a solid 90% of it has come to fruition, and I continue to work on the other 10%, even though I haven't looked at that statement in years. And even though I wouldn't have admitted it at the moment I wrote it, the statement was at least 50% accurate at the time. The writing, intensely writing and rewriting about who I am, gave me permission to stop thinking about failing who I am and just live who I am. Reverend Richard also writes, "Storytelling is powerful, and power is not inherently good or bad. It is simply power. One of the reasons we talk about stories here and how our stories are created and almost limitless possibilities of reviewing, renewing, revising, and transforming our stories is precisely so we can be mindful about the process, our intentions, and our purpose. It is part of nurturing spiritual growth. It allows for many stories among individuals and within individuals, but it requires a rigorous honesty and deep humility." Sorry. He continues, "Sometimes viewing my story from a different perspective allows me a new understanding of my actions and the actions of others and unlocks reservoirs of compassion that I had not realized were even available from within me. And sometimes I am weaving a story so as to justify something that I am unsure of, to blame others for something that is my responsibility. Weaving a narrative, not a journey toward what is true, but to hide from it. Storytelling is powerful, yes, which means it must be grounded in what is real. Even the most far-flung fantasies, grounded in what is real and pointed to what is true. And in telling stories, I must be humble enough to know that whatever story I am telling is a story among stories. And we should remember that we are not only creators of stories, but we are created by stories. We need to be fearless in investigating the story into which we were born." So, Rosie, I was born with some of the stories that have played out in my head for years. Or if not born, they entered my psyche before anything else I can remember. Others wrote themselves, or I wrote them after repeated exercises that seemed to cement one type of lesson after another, some good and some bad. Much like the muscle memory of riding a bike or playing piano, the basic parts of those stories can hold me back or push me forward. But learning that I can edit those stories, tell myself the different versions of the truth game in my head, has helped me break through the negative story spiral that can fast track me to some dark places. Now I can say, well, I screwed that up, and say, I learned a few things, and then say, wow, now I'm going to do even better next time. I use this tactic, too, to strengthen relationships. I play the or game to challenge myself for any statement of truth that I recognize. So when I think something like, that person is so annoying, I might stop and think, or? So then I have to acknowledge, or they just want to be heard. Or? Okay, or I'm having a hard day and it's hard for me to focus on their words. All of that can be true. The person can be annoying, wanting to be heard, and I need a nap before I can give them my full attention. Reverend Richards brings us back to some ultimate lessons of storytelling and wraps it up. He says, "Sometimes stories are told in order to connect ourselves with others and with other stories. Sometimes stories are told and repeated over and over in order to silence all other stories. We are a community of stories. The free and responsible search for truth and meaning affirmed in our principles is all about the stories we create and the responsibility we bear to ground our stories in what is real and to listen deeply to the stories of others. Our lives become stories and stories shape our lives. We display our stories in the ways in which we respond to one another and to life itself. The sorrows that have broken our hearts, the injustices that have aroused our righteous anger, the embarrassments we survived, the mistakes we've made, the lessons we've learned, the communities we've helped to nourish in the vast interconnected network of our stories. These come out in our everyday actions. It is important to be aware of our stories as we strive to know ourselves better. It is important to listen to one another's stories as we strive to understand one another more deeply. It is important to realize that we are not simply creatures responding to the stimuli of the world. We are creators, we are artists, we are writers writing a new page every day in the story of our lives. I'd be happy to have a discussion. I don't know about questions, but I would love to hear what others think about this idea of storytelling and rewriting and multiple truths.
I was kind of thinking that I kind of do a version of that in my head a lot.
The war game?
Yeah. Who has a question? Oh, here we go. Eileen.
Not so much a question, but an affirmation. People have been telling me for years, as I've been telling stories at dinners and stuff, you really need to write a book. And I've just sort of poo-pooed that, but I'm putting together a book for my children of documents and pictures and family trees and stuff like that. And in the process, I started downloading my journals that I've been keeping for the last few years. And so I am in the process of writing that book. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing is, you talk about affirmation. I found two letters from my brother, who they weren't directed at me because he's been writing his own book, and two of those chapters related to me and my family and were affirmations of what I was experiencing from my family that nobody would believe through the years. So that was a gift to me from him.
Thanks for sharing that, Rosie. I just loved it. And the storytelling, I think, in with what's happening in the world today or in this country today, the stories that we tell ourselves has shaped our political views and our opinions. And for me, it's helpful to understand that people come from a different place and have created the story for themselves, and that's how they can have certain beliefs that I can't really understand, but I haven't walked in their shoes, and so having a little bit of compassion, I think, has helped me not fly off the handle or my head explode or whatever. And the idea that there can be one person and that we're looking at, and I feel that person is of zero character, and another person sees them as full of character. And it's so confusing, but understanding that we all have our stories kind of makes it a little bit easier to make some kind of sense of what appears to be madness.
Well, and thank you, Rosie. This was a valuable session, and on a different topic. This is what we as a church, I think, can offer the community if we start these evening, one evening a month or some sort of session and open to the community and explain this topic and dress it up a little bit and get people interested in our church.
I've thought about maybe offering an open mic night here, and especially trying to get it advertised out to young people, because there's a Moth Radio Hour that if you haven't heard, you should look up and listen to. There are incredible stories on the Moth Radio Hour. There's also something called Button Poetry, which is people getting on stage and reciting. A lot of times it's reverse. And there's some really incredible stuff there, too. And older people do, too, but especially younger people are really into this stuff. And I think we might do well to offer that. And I would love it, too. And I used to, from 92 till about 98, have no idea how many people I talked to about trans issues and being a trans person and all that stuff. And I've never actually, I've kind of walked around the edges of it, but I've never done it here, so I think maybe I'll set up a sermon for me to do to talk about. Although usually it was a human sexuality class or something. I had an hour or an hour and a half. But we can condense it down. But I think that would be fun.
This was at the beginning, but what you had said about fake news and misinformation had reminded me of the other day, my sister and I were playing a trivia game, and we both answered really quickly. And I said, well, I said it first. And she said, well, I said it louder. And we laughed and laughed and laughed and laughed. And I said, boy, you should be a newscaster. One of the, you know, talking heads on the shows. And it just really reminded me of, especially that last paragraph that the Reverend wrote. I really resonated with, I really do believe that it is our job and our responsibility as Unitarian Universalists in our community to open those conversations and hold multiple truths, but also fact check people. No, trans people actually have always existed. And I know you're hurting, and I hear you. I don't think it's the woke agenda, but you know, let's talk about it. If we feel safe to do so, let's have that discussion. Yeah, I think that's a very important task that we all have.
Come around.
I love this discussion.
Thank you so much. I was so looking forward to this. I was sure I knew the answer to the or. I was so sure. I'm going to be using that one. I might say and. One thing I just wanted to ask you is, you know, in the profession I'm in, we always talk about journaling, right? And some clients love to do that and some clients hate to do that. I've tried to do that and I end up writing so much that it's just so annoying and it's like, you know, how do I summarize it, you know? How do I get to the point? And because I know if I look back on it, it's going to be like this long. I don't want to read that, you know what I mean? So do you have any tips about how to journal or write about your experiences that makes it enjoyable to read and you want to go back and read it?
Well, the first thing I would say is I'm not sure journals are written for you to go back and read. I think it's written for you to get things out of your head. So, like, that's for me, that's the point of it, is to get it out of my head. And because when I go back and read things that I have journaled or therapy work that I was doing, I just want to throw it away. Like, I truly just want to throw it away. It's just drivel. I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I was ever in that space. And so it wasn't, like, it was for me to process those words and to get them out of my head, which helps, like, you know, release them from me. And to, the other thing, like you were saying, it gets really long. It goes on and on because I'm processing and reprocessing as I go along. And so maybe somewhere down towards the bottom, I get to the point that I need to know. So, yeah, like, I don't know that it is. If it's something you want to be able to share with others, then you just go through the process of rewriting. Like you do the thing, and then you go through it with a highlighter and pick out the good points, and then use that to write something new. But yeah, that journaling. I think it should be a brain dump. And I know with people who I've done this in working with people to teach them how to write, that if the act of writing or typing, however you're writing, isn't working for you, it could be, you know, people process things differently. So if you're more of a verbal or auditory processor, then speak, record yourself talking about the thing, record yourself talking to yourself about the thing. So it's an alone in the room experience, not you talking to a therapist, not you talking to a friend. And because I think that's where you start, like you process those thoughts that you wouldn't necessarily say out loud to any other person, even if you trusted them fully.
I stumbled across years ago, and this will come and make more sense in a minute, but some kind of a technical problem. And I was having trouble figuring it out, and there was a support person I could contact, and I would start writing it out. And the process of formalizing it in writing, probably 80% of the time, would give me the answer.
Yeah.
So I never had to send tech support. Well, I found the same thing applies if I'm having a problem with dealing with some more social type of situation. If I write it out to send it to a friend to help process it, a lot of times I figure out the answer too. And I'm wondering if you went back and, because there's a lot of editing when I do that to make sure I'm clear, and it's usually in the editing that I realize what the answer is. And I'm wondering if you took this long thing and went through and tried to edit it down, if you would learn things from it. I don't know whether that would work or not.
So journaling is not my thing either, but I do a form of that where I will draft an email or a text to a friend and then realize it's pages long and, like, you know, it's like anxiety pouring out of me. And so then I'll read back through it and think, oh, well, like, these 12 paragraphs are not necessary. They know this stuff about me. Like, they know this part. This is the point that I need to share with them. And then it's like that act of editing that makes me realize, oh, that is, like, all of that other stuff was just the anxiety. It's okay for me to let go of those things. And then maybe there is a little problem here that I need to work through with my friend or talk to someone about. Teresa's had her hand up for a while. I don't know if it's okay for her to go.
That was a lovely talk. I liked it. And there were many places in it where I felt some parallels. But the one I want to mention is the refinding of fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So I refound fiction a few years ago for myself. And I found fiction that I'd never read before, and it was fiction. A few years ago, I ended up reading every book that Lucy Maud Montgomery wrote, Anne of Green Gables.
Oh.
I'd never read that, and I found that the 10-year-old Teresa inside of me loved it, and it was like transportation to, like, 1978 Teresa laying in the grass under the picnic table, and it was amazing. I was wondering if you had, like, found 10-year-old Rosie again.
Yeah. I think finding my love of historical fiction was harkening back to 10-year-old Rosie. Little Women was my favorite book forever. And yeah, I think that was it, like reading the stories of real people, but with some historical background to it. And then the other thing that after I had started reading, you know, being on Goodreads and having friends, collections of friends on Goodreads, one of my close coworkers, not the prickly lady, but someone who was much younger than me, but we were so similar in so many ways, she was one of my great friends on Goodreads, and I would just look at every single thing she read. And so one day I was looking, and she read all of this young adult fiction. And so I was talking to her about it, and she was like, I love YA. Like, it is just the best. Like it was some deep, dark secret. And I was like, okay, tell me something to read, because I don't, you know, like, I think I read young adult fiction when I was, like, 10. You know, like, because I was reading ahead of my grade level, and so a lot of that stuff probably went over my head too, but because it was ahead of my personal experiences in life. So, anyways, I went back, started reading young adult fiction, and I love it. And right now, I've been discovering all of the newly written young adult fiction, which is much more diverse and speaks to the current world and current experiences of, they say young adult, it's really teenager fiction, but it's called young adult fiction, but it's teenagers through like early 20s. And I just love it so much because it shows me pieces of the world that I wouldn't normally see, that I'm never going to get to experience because I'll never be that age. And it makes me grateful not to be that age. so happy that I'm beyond that. And there's those great young adult writers like John Green whose stories really show you how these 15 to 25 year olds are having these difficult experiences as much as any 50 year old, they're going through it in their own ways. And it gives me that hope too, that fiction tends to give me, where it helps me remember that lots of people go through lots of things and I'm not the only one out there having whatever that experience is. There's not a single unique experience in the world. So.
Just one thing real quick. I just realized when we were talking about journaling that sometimes I will write a poem and it'll just come to me. And it might be serious and emotional or it might be silly. But I can't sit down and write a poem. It just comes to me, whenever. So maybe that's the way that I can express myself.
Back to Anne of Green Gables. Trans people, older trans people, like I was 42 when I started hormones. You follow the girls, if you're male or female or trans girl, as long as you can. But about puberty, they don't want the boys around anymore. So then you lose it. So what happens when you transition is emotionally you go back to about 12 or 13 years old, which was about the age of Anne of Green Gables. Well, my transition, I read Anne of Green Gables, all 10 books, which go through her adulthood and having children and having one of her kids die in World War I. And it was cathartic, and it was kind of growing up for me in that emotional way. So it was really a great experience.
Two votes for Anne of Green Gables. That's well, thank you.